Brad Bowen. I work for Shavlik Technologies. As you can see, I'm going to be talking about information security laws and regulations today. And one of the main things that I'm going to try and describe to you is a trend that I perceive. It's an emerging trend in information security law and regulation. Excuse me. And it's one towards what I call programmatic information security. What I mean exactly by programmatic should become clear in a few minutes. But just to get rid of any misconceptions that may exist from the outset, I'm not talking about an application here. I'm talking about more of a management, governance, strategic level type control activities in terms of an information security program. But as I said, I think that in the next couple of slides, I'll be able to very clearly articulate what an information security program means. If you take a look at this slide, you can see that in the last 4 years, roughly, the number of laws and regulations, particularly regulations that have to do with information security and impact the practice of information security, have expanded rather dramatically. From the period 74 to 1996, not a lot was happening in terms of strict data security. There's a great deal of legislation having to do with privacy. But in terms of controls, at least on the civil side, not the criminal side necessarily, but in terms of the civil side, defining what you can and cannot do with an information security program, say at a company, not a lot was going on. And then that situation changed and continues to change since about the year 2000. So it should be no surprise to anyone that spending on compliance-related activities is up, and compliance in general is a critical function. The majority of IT executives believe that overall IT spending will increase over the next 12 months, and that compliance with government laws and regulations is one of the key reasons, I really apologize for that, one of the key reasons for the increase in spending. Chief security officers are identifying compliance as one of the number one drivers of information security spending within the companies that they work for. And I know through my own personal experience that the amount of time that's being spent by information security and technology professionals, people like myself and the people that I'm speaking to now, all of you, that amount of time is increasing on a relatively steady basis. So in my presentation, I want to talk about three different things. The majority of the time will be given to patterns. And what I mean by patterns is the things that are shared in common and are consistent across all of the different information security laws and regulations. Once we understand what those patterns are, hopefully we can come up with responses that enable us to respond to compliance challenges that we all face in a more cost-effective fashion. And then at the end, I'll kind of go out on a limb a little bit and try and make some general predictions about what I think may happen in the future in terms of future security laws and regulations. So we'll start out with the public sector. We'll only cover three laws there, but this will provide us a very quick view of how the government action has evolved from pretty primitive regulation of information security to pretty highly evolved over the space of about 30 or so years, something like that. We'll start with the Privacy Act of 1974. This was one of the earliest attempts to regulate information security. It's targeted at federal agencies, primarily government institutions, and it's intended to protect personal information regarding citizens of the United States. So in that respect, it's kind of similar to some of the laws today. It's driven by the need to, or the desire to, protect sensitive information about individuals. Examples of the personal information that was contemplated and is contemplated by this law include things like educational and criminal history, medical backgrounds, financial transactional histories, things of that nature. It requires the use of, quote, appropriate administrative, technical, and physical safeguards to ensure the security and confidentiality of the private records that I was just talking about. And it goes no further than saying administrative, technical, and physical safeguards. It doesn't go any further. That doesn't say there needs to be card key entry to server closets, there needs to be network access controls in place, there need to be standard configurations of devices, anything like that. It's extremely high level and extremely abstract. So it really addresses stuff at the tactical control level only in what it calls safeguards. And those two terms, for my purposes, are synonymous. This is an example of a law that does not take a programmatic approach to security. But this begins to change with the Computer Security Act of 1987. This is the first law that required risk-based information security plans. And they use the word plan instead of program, but again, probably synonymous. This is again directed at the federal agencies. The scope of information that is being protected here is quite a bit larger. It's not just personal information about people. It is information, any kind of essentially non-classified information that's maintained on federal computing resources is covered by this act. So we've got, again, the administrative, technical, and physical controls that I talked about. But you've also got now, in the upper part of the slide, you've got what I'm going to call program requirements. Those program requirements are, first, that the program has to be documented so that if somebody coming in off the street after a year after the program or the plan has been set down is able to adequately review and assess the plan and understand what control measures are in place to protect the data that that the Security Act is intended to protect. Second, as I mentioned, the program has to be risk-based, and I think we all pretty much know what that is. If we're protecting extremely sensitive information, then in that case, we would be required to use controls that are commensurately more rigorous. If we're protecting less sensitive information, the level of controls that need to be in place would be less rigorous. And then finally, there needs to be a periodic review. This is actually kind of a weak requirement. The program needs to be revised annually as necessary. And so theoretically, one could go several years without having to actually revise and review the plan. And then again, we've got administrative, technical, and physical controls, but now the law is starting to dictate particular types of controls that need to be put in place. This is a somewhat high-level control, security awareness and training, but nevertheless, it is specifically required by the Computer Security Act. So now we flash forward to over a decade to the Federal Information Security Act, or FISMA, as it's called. And this is part of the Bush administration's national strategy to secure cyberspace. It supersedes and replaces the Computer Security Act of 1987. And like the Computer Security Act, it is intended to protect non-classified information on federal computing systems, a very broad application, not just the private data. It builds upon and extends the requirements of the Computer Security Act. It builds on them by quite a bit. And here we've got the first explicit use of the word program, requiring the agencies to develop, document, and implement an agency-wide information security program. So again, we've got the two major categories that we've seen in the previous slides. The program requirements, some of them are carried forward, the critical ones, but we're also adding some new ones. Management sponsorship. In this case, it means that, for example, within an agency, the director of the agency needs to take ultimate responsibility to make sure that information security is implemented appropriately, that the program is implemented and operational. Next, we've got, again, periodic testing and reporting, which we saw in the previous act. But in this case, the requirement is slightly more stringent. The review has to be conducted no less than annually, and perhaps more frequently if circumstances warranted. So a more aggressive control in that respect. Strategic policies and procedures. And by this, I mean really high-level kind of strategic items, obviously. An example might be the roles and responsibilities of the various key players within the information security program, including the director of the agency, the chief information officer, the chief security officer, things of that nature. And then there also has to be a mechanism for program improvement. This would come in response to the annual review. If there are deficiencies identified within the information security program, within either the management of the program, which is the part that I'm most interested in, or the control structures that are in place to protect the information, those deficiencies need to be identified, and then they have to be corrected. There has to be some kind of documented way in which those deficiencies are mitigated or those risks are mitigated. Again, we have administrative, technical, and physical controls with one of the ones that we've seen before, but again, we're adding some. And the very first one is an extremely broad-based one, subordinate plans for securing networks, facilities, and systems. And this could cover everything from network access control to operating system access control to application access control, you name it. This is an extremely far-reaching requirement. Next, there need to be incident response procedures. Pretty standard practice now at most companies that I visit. There's some kind of written, articulated incident response procedure that's followed to detect and deal with intrusions into your network. And then finally, there need to be disaster recovery plans. What happens in the case of some kind of usually an unpredictable type catastrophic event, such as a fire or flood in your data center? So just to draw out this distinction one more time, at the top we've got kind of the program development and maintenance. And this is kind of more, these are all controls in one way or another. They're all measures that are put in place to protect information more or less. Some of them are more high level than others. And so I make kind of a synthetic distinction between them to highlight something that's important to this presentation. At the top we've got controls that are more interested with program development and maintenance, the management of the program, the development and the ongoing management of the program itself. At the bottom of the control section, we've got lower level tactical stuff. This is what your system administrators are doing on a day-to-day basis. They're implementing these types of controls. So again, at the top, we've got the management plan for selecting controls, determining which ones are appropriate, and then down below, we've got the controls themselves that we apply to the specific technologies to protect information. And so with that, we'll turn towards an analysis of some of the laws that affect the private sector. The first one, it's important to understand the difference between laws and regulations, because this is something that you'll see in every single one of the, most every slide that we cover from here until the end of the presentation. The United States Congress, at the federal level anyway, is the only body that's capable of issuing what are called laws. By using these laws, because Congress is unable essentially to regulate every type of human activity or business activity that's conducted in the United States on a day-to-day basis, they need to delegate some of that authority to other organizations. These are called agencies. So using a law, the Congress will set up something like the Securities and Exchange Commission, give them specific jurisdiction over a special type of, in this example, publicly traded companies, and then allow them to develop an expertise around how to regulate those industries and to come up with what are called rules. This is synonymous with regulations. Rules, regulations, it's the same thing. And then Federal Trade Commission, United States Postal Service, all examples of agencies that develop rules. So first of all, we'll talk about the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act. This was signed into law by President Clinton in 1999. It applies to public and private financial institutions of many, many different kinds. And it requires federal agencies that oversee financial institutions to develop rules or regulations that are designed to protect the privacy of customer financial information. Examples of this information would include things like loan or credit card applications, payment histories, purchase histories, things like that. And there, out of this, there come two major information security-related requirements. First is known as the privacy rule. And what the privacy rule essentially says is that unless certain notification, it basically prohibits the disclosure of this customer financial information unless certain notification and opt-out requirements are met. If you ever wondered why you get those kind of like multi-part, multi-syllabic, incredibly complex documents that list out your bank's privacy statements or your privacy policies, this is probably the reason that they're sending them to you. And then the second part, the one that we're actually much more interested in, is the safeguards rule. And what the safeguards rule does is it prescribes the actual minimum security standards that need to be put in place by a financial institution to protect the information. So several federal agencies have issued regulations under the Act. We'll talk about a few of them, or two of them actually. We'll talk about the federal banking agencies as a group, and then we'll also talk about the Federal Trade Commission. By the federal banking agencies, this would include the Office of the Comptroller of Currency, Office of Thrift Supervision, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and I think there are actually ones that examine the banks, though. The Federal Reserve System, that's the one I was trying to think of. So the Federal Reserve Banks are included here as well. They came out with what are called the Interagency Guidelines for Safeguarding Customer Information. In other words, their implementation of the Safeguards Rule. They came out with it jointly in February of 2001, and they were issued on the same day, and they're virtually identical. So we'll talk about them as if they were identical for purposes of this presentation. And what they require the banks to do is essentially establish comprehensive written information security programs. So again, as we look at the requirements of the program, we can see that we've got the two major divisions, and we've got a lot of the same program requirements we saw in the public sector regulation, but here we're adding some additional ones as well. This isn't really a control, but it's worth putting in there because it's very often mentioned in legislation. The safeguards that are put in place need to be appropriate to the size and complexity of the organization. Another way to say it would be that they need be no more rigorous than the size and complexity of the organization would warrant. So a large international banking concern would probably have to have much more rigorous control measures in place to protect its information than would a local credit union, for example. There needs to be a designated program coordinator. And this is different from management involvement because the person that's at the CEO level, for example, is not the person that's going to have kind of day-to-day responsibility for overseeing the health of the program. Not the health of the controls, for example, but the health of the program. What this does is it makes sure that there is a single individual or a group of individuals that is identified specifically as being responsible for more or less the day-to-day status and health of the information security program itself. And then finally, we add something called third-party oversight. And this is also something that we'll see again and again. What I mean by third-party oversight is, for example, if I'm a bank, and I take some of my customer financial information and I outsource it, give it to some other organization for analysis and processing. I need to make sure, either by contract or by some other mechanism, that when that information is in the hands of the third party, it receives the same level of protection that it would have had it remained strictly under my control within the bank. And that's what service party or third party management or third party oversight is all about. Turning to the administrative, technical, and physical controls, again, we're carrying forward some of the primary ones that we've seen previously, but we're also adding, for example, intrusion detection systems. So now we've got, of course, incident response is required, but now they're actually mandating a specific type of technology that we integrate into our incident response program itself or plan. Access controls, including authentication and authorization. So for applications, for example, that deal with customer financial data, only authorized users can access the information, and those users need to be authenticated before they're granted access. Physical access restrictions, which I think is pretty obvious. This means making sure that if a server maintains customer financial information, not everybody can just walk up to it and kick it over, take a sledgehammer to it, whatever. The consideration of encryption of customer financial information both while in transit and while at rest. Change control procedures, making sure that if we're going to make a significant change to a system that's processing this type of information, that our proposed change has been thoroughly tested before it's implemented to make sure that nothing goes wrong, or hopefully nothing goes wrong. Personnel security measures, and this would include things like employee background checks prior to hiring, dual control procedures, segregation of duties, things of that nature. And then environmental protection measures, that's another one, and of course I don't mean like save the trees or anything like that, but this is of course designed to like make sure that you've got a fire suppression system in your data center, for example. Again, we've got periodic control testing, but now we've got a slightly different flavor. In this case, it needs to be conducted or reviewed by independent staff or an independent third party. And so this takes the review requirement to another level. In other words, the people that come up with the information security program need to be different from the people that make sure that it's functioning normally. And so we eliminate the kind of bias that might be there. Next, we'll talk about what the Federal Trade Commission did. That's another federal agency. They were also asked, required, to develop safeguards rules underneath the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act. They did so. They're called the Standards for Safeguarding Customer Information, and they were issued in May of 2002 with a compliance deadline approximately a year after that. For those of you that don't know, the FTC's primary objective is to enforce consumer protection laws and protect private individuals in their dealings with companies. Consumer protection, in a nutshell. And as we look at the FTC standards, you can see that, again, we've got a written information security program as a baseline type of requirement, but in this case, it is somewhat less robust, quite a bit less robust, actually, than the interagency guidelines, which is only to be expected, I think, because... This guy's going to take a picture here. is that a good one? Thank you. Well, let's see, where was I? All this publicity stuff is like making my head spin here. So we're talking about the FTC, and they've got their requirements are less robust than the interagency guidelines. You can see them here. Again, as far as the programmatic or the management element, we're carrying all the same things forward, but we are adding one additional control item. Secure disposal procedures for media that would have contained customer financial information, for example. Yes, sir?
You were going to say why the FTC standards
are different. Oh, yeah. Well, in general, the FTC would regulate institutions that are not banks, for example. Typically banks in general are the ones that have the highest standards applied to them. So these would be kind of other... You know, more they're not banks. They're like quasi-financial institutions, like maybe mortgage-backed securities or something like that, where the need for extreme security is not perceived to be as great. Short answer to that one. So the one thing that the FTC standards add, sir. Yeah, when I said specifying a technology, I guess I meant, you know, it could be something that simple. They're certainly not saying you need to use a certain type, like, for example, network-based versus host-based or anything like that. But they are saying that you have to have more than just a written response plan. You need to have a process, an actual activity, and it could be, like you say, it could be a manual activity. It wouldn't necessarily need to be a technological one. Sir? Yep, and the incident response would cover that as well. So not just incidents that involving intrusion into the network, but an incident involving, say, somebody within the organization speaking at a public function all of a sudden says a bunch of, you know, basically let's fly a bunch of information relating to customers of the bank, for example. It would cover those types of items as well. This gentleman's asking kind of what part of the bank it applies to, and actually it would apply to all different kinds of the banks. The criteria for its application is not really the kind of activity that's being conducted. It's whether or not that activity involves the type of customer financial information that's covered by the regulation. So if it's a loan operation, if it's a savings operation, it doesn't matter. If it involves the collection and use of that type of information, then it's a covered activity. Mm-hmm. Well, that would be part of the third-party oversight requirement. And what you would do, I don't want to get too far afield. And I was actually going to say if we could reserve our questions to the end. I've got kind of a lot of stuff to get through, but I will answer this one. What you would do typically is you would have a contract with the organization, the third party, and this requires you to have some kind of an arrangement. And you would have a contract in which you would state that the person that signs it, say it's a company in India, for example, agrees to be subject to a lawsuit in whatever jurisdiction in the United States that the bank happens to operate in, whatever jurisdiction it chooses. So that's kind of how you don't have to sue them under any international law. You can use a American law, United States law, to do it. Or potentially you could use the law of their country, but I can't imagine a contract ever being written that way. So, and if you were wondering why information disposal, like secure disposal procedures, weren't part of the interagency guidelines, it was kind of a solecism or kind of a big oversight on the part of the regulation or the agencies rather that came up with those regulations. But I'm told that under something called the Fair and Accurate Credit Transactions Act, that secure media disposal procedures will now be required in all of those different, by all of the federal agencies overseeing financial institutions, and that in pretty short order in the near term, the interagency guidelines will be amended to have a similar requirement to what you see here. Next, we'll turn to the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. Like GLBA, Gramm-Leach-Bliley, this is another data-driven type of piece of, another data-driven type of legislation. But in this case, we're dealing with healthcare information rather than financial information. It was enacted in 1996, and the interesting thing about HIPAA is that it recognizes that a great deal, perhaps the majority of healthcare information that's maintained on citizens in this country is maintained electronically. And as a result of that, Subtitle F of the Act requires the Department of Health and Human Services to come up with a rule, just like under GLBA, that ensures the privacy and the security of the healthcare information. So again, you see two major regulations evolving out of this. The first, a privacy rule. Who can access, who can see this healthcare information? To whom can it be delivered? When can they see it? All those types of things. Who can use it? And then you've also got a safeguards type rule, which prescribes, again, minimum security standards with which that information has to be handled. Although in the context of HIPAA, we don't call it a safeguards rule. It's referred to commonly as the HIPAA security rule, but it's essentially identical in its intent anyway. The reason that we're talking, HIPAA was passed in 96, GLBA was passed in 99, and the reason I'm talking about the security standards rule now in the presentation after GLBA is because the Department of Health and Human Services did not issue its final rule defining security standards until, I think it was February of 2003. So as you look at the next slide, in which we'll go over the HIPAA security standards, keep in mind that as the people were coming up with these things, they had the interagency guidelines, for example, to look at and to see how those had worked. And I think you see a lot of overlap in the coverage there. HIPAA talks about, instead of using the word controls, HIPAA uses instead a term called implementation specifications. And these specifications can be either required or addressable. Required specifications are exactly what they sound like. You have to, every organization is required to implement them. Addressable ones are a little bit different. Addressable means that they have to be evaluated to determine whether or not they're appropriate for the institution that is thinking about implementing them. And if they determine that they're not appropriate, they have to give a documented reason why and attempt to implement some alternative safeguard if they can. Due to time constraints in this presentation, I'll only be talking about required specifications. So in this slide, we see the required specifications, required implementation specifications for HIPAA. And as you can see, again, the pattern, we're carrying forward most of the same management type controls that we've seen in the previous slides. And we're also bringing forward a lot of the same tactical level control items that we've seen in the previous legislation as well. We are adding, in this case, two additional ones having to do with workstation use and security. Workstation use simply means if a workstation is able to access protected healthcare information, then there have to be only certain people can access that. There have to be rules about who can access it, what time they can access it, when, how long, what they can do with it, things of that nature. And workstation security has simply to do with respect again to those same systems, physical security measures around them, making sure that people can't, you know, get within 50 feet of them unless they have a reason to be there. So no discussion of compliance and information security would be complete without talking at least briefly about Sarbanes-Oxley. This is kind of the poster child right now of compliance. It's the one that's getting, I think, the most visibility. because it has such broad application. And I think, well, first of all, as you probably all know, it was passed in 2002. It was kind of in response to a wave of big financial scandals, really huge financial scandals involving companies like Enron, Tyco, WorldCom, Adelphia. The list goes on and on. And it applies to companies that are publicly traded, in other words, companies that are registered with the SEC. And I think that one of the main reasons why it's getting so much spin in companies and why it's got such a high profile, I think the revised compliance deadline, and somebody can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think it's now in November of this year for larger companies anyway.
Fourth quarter?
Yep. So it's come in any way. It's coming up. They moved it back, but it's still looming on the horizon. Yeah, accelerated filers or whatever that is. Yeah. So due in part, I think, to the fact that violations of Sarbanes-Oxley can wind chief executive officers in jail, I think that's one of the main reasons that it's being taken very seriously. Just to give you an example, a violation of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, a willful violation of it, can be punished with a fine of up to $5 million and a prison term of up to 20 years. So it's a fairly significant penalty. Then again, on the other hand, I mean, $5 million to a chief executive officer may not be a great deal of money, and you never really know where these CEOs are actually going to spend their prison terms. It may not be the most rigorous, facility, but anyway, the penalties are there, so it's being taken seriously. So the part that we're really interested in terms of Sarbanes-Oxley, is Section 404. What Section 404 requires in a nutshell is for management, the management of a company, to assess what is called internal, I have internal controls here, but it's internal control over financial reporting. And they have to do that on at least an annual basis. And they also have to have their assessment of the internal control attested to by a third-party auditor. So you're probably wondering, what is internal control over financial reporting? Well, in a very kind of a simplistic description of it would be that internal control is there, it exists, to ensure that the information that is generated by the company, the financial reporting information that is generated by a publicly traded company and winds up either in a quarterly report or more probably in an annual report, which is distributed to shareholders, potential investors, as well as its filings with the SEC. It's there to ensure that that financial information is accurate, reasonably accurate, when it winds up in the annual report. And so management needs to make an assessment of the internal control structure in which it says, yes, we believe and we have a basis for believing that what we present as in our annual report is our financial health is reasonably accurate, or no, we don't believe that it is. The interesting thing is that neither the Act itself nor the SEC's rule, which I think is called Regulation SP, actually mention information technology or information security specifically. So a lot of people kind of wonder sometimes why information security and information technology personnel, people like you and me, kind of spend a lot of time having to deal with Sarbanes-Oxley compliance activities. And the reason, the primary reason, I think, is because financial reporting is so inextricably linked or tied to the computer systems in a modern corporation. You really can't have reliable financial reporting unless you can rely on the applications that are processing the numbers. That being the case, the term internal control has been interpreted to include what are called IT general controls and application controls. Application controls are with respect to the applications that process and output this data for the annual reports. It means that the integrity of the data while it's within that application is protected by access controls, data processing type of integrity controls, things like that. That's a relatively narrow set of control objectives, really, and a relatively narrow thing, set of actual applications, for example, relatively narrow, that a company would have to examine. Where the scope of Sarbanes-Oxley really explodes is when you talk about what are called IT general controls. And IT general controls really can include almost everything related to information technology and security. The theory is that unless we can guarantee that the operating system, for example, or the network infrastructure that the application runs on top of is reliable, how can we really be certain that the application, the security of the application itself is reliable? For example, if the operating system that the application is running on, Windows 2000 Server, is wide open, then we begin to have doubts about the veracity of the application that's running on Windows 2000 Server and the data, the information that it's outputting. And so, IT general controls can be and has been interpreted to include everything from database management to network access controls to disaster recovery, you name it. At some point, somebody has to, and they, another, I think they call Sarbanes-Oxley the Full Employment Act for auditors and consultants or something like that, you know? And it's kind of true. I mean, it's kind of in there. Yeah, go ahead. Oh, okay. All right, that's good information to know. Well, at least they're not going, you know, totally overboard. Okay. Thanks for that information. So I think that you know, the reason why it's been interpreted so broadly maybe sometimes has to do with the fact that the more broadly it's interpreted, the more work is out there for people, you know, like myself. I don't do this, I swear to God, but for people like myself and also for companies, you know, like Ernst & Young, KPMG, the auditors that have to actually come in and do the validation or the attestation report. And so even though a written information security program is not required, documentation is paramount, very important for Sarbanes-Oxley compliance. Companies are required under the regulation to generate what essentially amounts to proof that establishes the veracity or truth of management's assessment of internal control over financial reporting. So in other words, if management says our financial reporting process is fine and the results are reasonably accurate, there has to be some kind of documented evidence to that effect. If they say that it's not, again, there has to be some kind of, you know, basis for that judgment. It's one of the first things that an auditor will look through when they come through the door. They'll ask for this type of documentation, whether it's a network diagram, a flowchart, a narrative, a policy or procedure, something like that. They'll ask for that, they'll look at that, and then they'll move on to actually examining the systems themselves and making sure that in reality what the company is doing matches up with what they're doing on paper. So I think the main conclusion I want you to draw from this discussion of Sarbanes-Oxley is, I think you can see, because that this is an annual requirement and sometimes even more frequently required than that, and because documentation is such an important part of it, unless it can be reduced to coordinated, documented, repeatable processes, Sarbanes-Oxley compliance is going to be extremely expensive. I think one estimate is that Fortune 1000 companies will spend about $5 million on Sarbanes-Oxley just through 2005. And so there needs to be, in other words, there needs to be an information security program that has most of the elements that we've seen in the other laws and regulations. And if we have that, we'll go a long way towards basically providing all the documentation, at least, that we need to support our Sarbanes-Oxley and providing and actually having the controls in place as well that would support management's assessment over internal control. Next, we'll talk about the Federal Trade Commission Act. This is kind of an interesting one. Under Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act, the FTC has the power to punish deceptive trade practices. And this power has recently been used against a number of very prominent companies, including Microsoft, Eli Lilly, which is a pharmaceuticals company, the makers of Guess Clothing, the Guess Corporation, I'm guessing, and ToysMart.com. And typically what happens is a company will make some kind of a promise in its privacy statement and then will break that promise by committing some lapse in security. And excellent. And what will wind up happening then is the FTC will bring in what's called an enforcement action under Section 5 of the FTC Act. An excellent example of this is the case of Tower Records. This decision, or the consent order in this case, came out in April of this year, so it's quite recent, and it's an excellent example of what an FTC enforcement action looks like. So Tower Records had on its website they had a privacy statement like, you know, so many websites do. It's perfectly appropriate and it's a good thing to have. Their statement included things like, quote, your privacy is important to us, okay? We use state-of-the-art technology to safeguard your information. And then finally, your telerecords.com information is password protected. You and only you have access to this information. And now they've raised the bar pretty high for themselves. They've said, you know, they've made a quite an explicit promise. And unfortunately, they wound up breaking that promise due to the redesign of basically what's you'd refer to as kind of the checkout part of their e-commerce website. This is where the customer would, after they've made the selections of the types of music that they want to purchase online, they go to the checkout portion, they see what's in their shopping basket, they enter payment information, they receive an order number, and then they can go back in, they can check with this order status number, you know, has the stuff been shipped, is it on back order, what's, you know, where is it at? Well, as part of the redesign of the checkout interface, they also rewrote the code for the order status application. And the order status application was just simply a subcomponent of the overall checkout interface. And its specific responsibility was to take status, or to take order numbers rather, and then retrieve the information about them. Just as I said before, whether it was on back order, whether it's been sent, essentially the, whatever the status of the customer's order is. Unfortunately, the rewritten order status application did not include any code to authenticate the user. So, in other words, no name and password was required. All that you had to do was enter a valid order number, and you would be able to view any of the information having to do with that order. As a result of this, information related to over, I think it was 5,200 Tower Records consumers was viewed by unauthorized users. It wound up in some internet chat rooms. People had lively discussions about the purchasing habits of, you know, these individuals. And some of the things that they would be able to see would be the consumer's name, their billing and shipping address, their phone number, their email address, and a complete purchase history of everything that they'd ever bought online at Tower Records. So, of course, the FTC brought under Section 5 an enforcement action. And they said, basically, Tower Records had made a promise in their privacy statement to their customers that this order status information would be protected with some kind of authentication mechanism. They broke this promise when they rewrote the order status application. And then Tower Records came back with saying, in a fairly reasonable argument, they said, you know, look, we are, just because we don't have every known vulnerability or problem that you can have with a website of this type, an e-commerce application of this type, just because we're not addressing every single one of those doesn't mean that we don't take security seriously at Tower Records. We have a certain window of time within which we're able to, you know, identify these vulnerabilities and apply whatever corrective measures are appropriate to close them. And unfortunately for them, the FTC pointed out that the information, basically this is not really a patching issue so much as just a coding issue. Information on this type of problem, which is basically user account and session management, information on closing that type of vulnerability had been available since at least the year 2000 and had been available to the general public. And so it was pretty tough for them to come back and say, well, what we're doing is reasonable. They'd had 3 years to get it right, and they'd failed to do so in the latest release of this code. And so the result, I hope, by now is fairly predictable. They were ordered to implement and maintain a comprehensive information security program. The program requirements, I won't bother reading through them. They're, again, what you've seen previously. What they're most similar to is the FTC's safeguards rule under the GLB Act. In fact, my assumption is just that they took basically what they thought were the critical elements of that rule and just put them in place here. There was one interesting wrinkle, however. Tower Records was also required to obtain an independent assessment of their security program every 6 months. So, and I know that, for example, under the interagency guidelines with the banks that we talked about previously, there was an independent assessment requirement, an independent audit requirement. However, in that case, the bank could use independent staff that worked for the organization. They didn't have to use an actual independent third party. In this case, the FTC is requiring that the Tower Records does use an independent third party. And I would just draw your attention to the fact that, first of all, This is a much more substantial review requirement, for one thing. And second, it also makes it kind of similar to Sarbanes-Oxley. Because in Sarbanes-Oxley, you can't have management's assessment attested to by internal, independent staff that still works for the company. It has to be somebody that wasn't involved in setting up the internal control structure to begin with. So this is kind of an innovation in terms of keeping tabs on the true health of the information security program within an organization.
Is that 6 months indefinitely?
I beg your pardon?
Is that 6 months indefinitely, or is there some time?
I don't know the answer to that. I could find out pretty quickly, like after the presentation, and let you know like how long that goes for. I imagine that it was for some term, some period of time, but. Yeah, it wouldn't be perpetually. So before we turn to kind of the final, basically the primary final part of the presentation, I wanted to say a few quick words about negligence liability. This is, in some circles, this is kind of like the holy grail that everybody's looking for in terms of being able to sue companies based on inadequate information security. One of the main reasons, or one of the big criticisms that's oftentimes leveled at the information security laws and regulations that we just talked about, is that they do not provide what's called a private cause of action for people. In other words, citizens are not allowed to sue to enforce violations, for example, of the HIPAA Act. Only the they can file a complaint with the Department of Health and Human Services, and then the Department of Health and Human Services can do something. Either do something or not do something based on that complaint, but nothing ever goes back to the consumer based on that violation. That's not to say that there might not be other avenues in which, they could recover because of the disclosure of information, but as far as HIPAA itself is concerned, a private citizen has no individual right to recover damages if they're under the HIPAA Act. So what are the elements of a negligence action? The first is there needs to be a duty of care. Second, there has to be some kind of a breach of that duty of care. Third, damages, measurable damages of some kind to the plaintiff. And then finally, proximate cause, which just simply means that there has to be a relationship, causal relationship, between the breach of the duty on the defendant's part and the damages sustained by the plaintiff. Even though, to the best of my knowledge anyway, and anybody that can correct me on this, please do, but as far as I know, there has never successfully been brought an action for negligence based on information, like lax information security practices. But if we look at some of the stuff that we've already talked about, and I'll just talk about one of them, the FTC enforcement actions, I think we can kind of see some signposts on the road that indicate that this type of liability may not be a complete pipe dream. To take a look at the Tower Records case, what was their duty of care? Their duty of care was to maintain a reasonably secure website, or to maintain with reasonable security the customer information that it collected about the visitors to Tower Records' website. What was the breach of that duty of care? When they screwed up the rewrite of the order status application and failed to include authentication code. What were the damages? Well, in this case, the damages really might not have been all that significant. Potentially identity theft because of some of the types of information that was disclosed, but just imagine if it had been another part of the website that had been compromised, the part that actually processed the payment information itself, and account numbers were compromised as well, then one could quite easily imagine identity theft occurring and, a quite significant amount of financial damages to the plaintiff. And then finally, proximate cause. No injury would have happened to the Tower Records customer unless Tower Records itself had been negligent in the design of its order status application. So it's very much, that enforcement action is very much what a negligence liability lawsuit by an individual would look like. Sir?
So
And was that done? Was that sued in the United States?
You know, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know where they sued them.
I'll have to talk to you. Okay, well, I'll probably follow up with you right after this if I can. I'd be interested to hear more.
There,
yeah?
There have been press reports about the United States case about a doctor, a physician in Pennsylvania who was lax on his data security. Patient information was exposed.
Mm-hmm.
And his patient sued under his malpractice insurance. You know,
yeah.
If you sue the doctor, you sue their malpractice insurance company, which has already assigned to liability. And there was actually, according to press reports, a substantial payment made. And then, of course, the doctor's malpractice insurance rates get jacked up.
Mm-hmm.
You or I would get into a bad car accident and our insurance rates go up.
And that's a good example. I wouldn't consider that's not precisely a negligence liability claim, but like the FTC enforcement action, it has most of the elements of a negligence liability claim in it. So, yeah, one more on this one.
What about the government breach of the data in California? The government, I recommend that the government employee has to send numbers in the case of the UCLA hospital with a subcontract relating to Pakistan was going to sell the data and didn't make another dollar on them.
That one I'm not aware of. The only one I'm aware of is the one that the incident at the Teal Center that led to the passage of SB 1386. But the one you're talking about, I'm not familiar with. I'm sorry.
There was a major data breach of the employment database. So basically, every employer got a notice under SB 1386 that
they don't
have your employee may have been briefed and now you need to tell them.
And SB 1386 is interesting because it's not really interesting because it doesn't really give the consumer a lot of power. All it entitles them to is a notice that they got screwed. It doesn't entitle them to, you know, any damages because they got screwed. But it is an example of a private citizen being able to file a lawsuit against a public company. So it's interesting for that reason. So next I want to turn to just a couple other government actions. You may kind of decide that they're inactions when you hear a little bit more about them. The first one, the proposed Corporate Information Security Accountability Act, was something that got a fair amount of press last year. And I would expect that some of you at least are at least vaguely familiar with it. A Republican from Florida, Representative Adam Putnam, came up. He's the head of a subcommittee dealing with information technology, among a number of other things like the census. And he came up with some draft legislation entitled the Corporate Information Security Accountability Act. What that act would have required is for companies to include in their annual report, just like with Sarbanes-Oxley, an assessment of their current existing information security program. Now, what that program would have looked like is, here again, very similar to what the FTC is requiring under its GOP safeguards rule, what the FTC was requiring of TAR records in the enforcement action. You've got all the same type of programmatic requirements, including independent program auditing. You're only adding something in terms of actual tactical controls. You're adding something called asset inventories, which just means, like, for in the example of something like laptops, you purchase a laptop, you track it through the organization, who uses it, what data goes on it, and then when it's served its useful life, then you retire it in a way that makes sure that all the important information that was on there is scrubbed off, that type of thing. But this piece of legislation never passed beyond the draft status, and so a lot of people kind of wonder what happened. I really wondered what happened. I thought it was going to be pretty sweet if that got passed. It'd be a lot more be a lot more work for consultants, I can tell you that. But what happened was Representative Putnam basically solicited feedback from individuals, trade associations, corporations, all sorts of entities. And I can only assume that that feedback was overwhelmingly negative, or at least was more negative than it was positive. Ma'am. Well, Yeah, that's a good point. I guess I would. I think there were concerns about that. In the proposed legislation itself, it does make provisions for that, like the confidentiality of that information. That's not to say that companies weren't, even though that language was in the proposed act, that they still weren't concerned about it, as you say. But it definitely was, that was something that they took into consideration when they drew it up.
Yeah. I had an opportunity to ask you to spend some time with some of the people that I would be.
Okay.
And the feedback that I received from them was, one of the problems they're having right now is that many of the organizations represented on the working group are vendor organizations creating some pretty untenable situations for those people, not to mention just a huge amount of work. So they've gone back, and the plan is they're going to review it, they're going to try and get some more independent input into it, and revisit the legislation.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you don't mind, I'm just going to carry on straight for just a little bit, and hopefully you'll have additional time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What I was going to say is that Putnam never said, he definitely said in his press release that came out with the recommendations of the Corporate Information Security Working Group, he said that the legislation wasn't dead, it was just postponed. You know, kind of like, show me that you can, everybody said we can do it ourselves, he said show me if you can do it yourself. And so what the working group came up with were essentially a set of best practice type recommendations that could be implemented by companies to improve their security. I don't know if anybody here has seen them, but they're pretty thin stuff. They're very general, they're very abstracted, they don't really offer a heck of a lot of guidance, and they really doesn't have much teeth at all. Bottom line is very much a laissez-faire, self-regulated type of approach. Jeez, holy cats. Which brings us, kind of a dark and scary noise there, to the national strategy to secure cyberspace. Wait a second. This is the Bush administration's national strategy to secure cyberspace. That's my mistake there. This was issued in February of 2003, and it makes the quite, valid observation that business, government, national defense, all of these different entities have developed a common reliance upon the internet in order to successfully conduct their operations. Because of this common reliance, they also have a very significant common vulnerability. And so what the national strategy tries to do is say, everybody needs to step forward, whether you're an individual, a company, a government agency, whatever you are, and take responsibility for that portion of cyberspace over which you have control. So as a home user, I need to make sure that my home network and PCs are secure. As a corporate administrator, I need to make sure that the corporate network is secure. As a government agency, so on and so forth. Again, the approach is very much one of self-regulation. And in some respects, I think that the national strategy is a little bit schizophrenic. On the one hand, it says that enterprises require clearly articulated or clear policies and strategies, programs rather, to audit against information security best practices. So they need some kind of clearly defined information security program. But on the other hand, it says that the position of the Bush administration, at any rate, is that legislation will not be the primary means used to secure cyberspace. So the vision of the national strategy is very much one that is anchored in the belief that companies will do the right thing on their own without having to be told to do that. And that's, something that you can take or leave. What I ask myself is, how well does that vision of what information security in the corporate world would look like match up to the reality? And in my estimation, at least some of the things that I've seen make me think that maybe the vision doesn't match up that well. For example, the number of companies reporting that they possessed an established information security policy decreased fairly significantly from 2003 to 2004. Another data point, fewer chief security officers believe that security is considered a routine part of their business. This, again, kind of tends to go against the philosophy that's espoused in the national strategy, the hope that companies will kind of get it on their own and do it. In fact, interestingly enough, in one survey, the majority of information security managers stated that they would actually welcome some type of federal legislation that prescribed minimum types of information security standards. So we're kind of split. Let's see. How much time do I have?
10 minutes.
10 minutes? Okay. I'm just going to, unfortunately, skip this part. So I told you at the at the beginning of this presentation, and let me just say one thing really quickly. The presentation that you're seeing here will be available on the blackhat.com website. The one that's actually included in the printed conference proceedings, I think, is, I can't remember if it's the CD. There's the CD proceedings and the written ones. And the outline that I have in there is much more detailed, much more extensive, so you may find answers to a lot of your questions in there. I just want to point out that it's kind of different and much more elaborate than this presentation version is. But anyway, I told you that I would talk about patterns, responses, and predictions. The pattern by now, I hope, is pretty obvious to you. There needs to be some type of, there's basically certain critical elements that appear in just about every law and regulation that we've discussed. Kind of like your model information security program. You've got the top level strategic management data, you know, overall operations type of controls, and then you've also got the more tactical level types of controls at the bottom. And this model has been used and expanded upon over time and has reached, I think, its fullest maturity to date within HIPAA. I don't know if you remember, but we talked only about required specifications. If I had included addressable specifications, we would have added at least another 20 items to the list that you saw on the slide, making it probably the most fully articulated information security program required by law at this point in time. And the response, I think, is also pretty obvious. Companies need to do what they can to create, develop, and maintain some type of information security program. And a lot of people, you know, when I state this conclusion, they say, well, you know, gee, this is that's really great, Brad, but, you know, our company's already spending a lot of money on other kinds of compliance-related activities. And to that response, I have two things that I'd like to point out. The first thing is that in most organizations, a lot of, especially the control-level type things, the tactical-level things, they're really already there. The thing that's really missing, the only thing that's missing is more kind of the management aspect of it. So you've got a lot of the framework there in place, and it's not a huge amount of distance that you need to go to get all the way to an information security program. The other thing I like to point out is that if you are a company that's subject to multiple different types of laws and regulations, which is, you know, not infrequently the case, an excellent example would be a large bank, like Wells Fargo, for example. Their company would be subject both to the interagency guidelines, just as one example, and also Sarbanes-Oxley. If they had an information security program in place that covered all the bases that we've listed in the last slide, the basic elements, they would be able to, at the same time, meet a lot of the different requirements of both different compliance challenges. Whereas the common practice is essentially to say, okay, here's a GLBA project, here's a SOX project. Everything will work in an independent silo, and there won't be any overlap between the information. That being the case, it's extremely inefficient and not very cost-effective. So having an information security program is a much more cost-effective approach to the problem. And again, it's not a one-size-fits-all type of solution here either. Large organizations are going to have greater requirements placed upon them, but smaller organizations like credit unions would have commensurately fewer requirements. So the burden shifts depending on the company's ability to bear it. Just quickly in passing, I can give you one excellent example of a published information security program standard. It's British Standard 7799 Part 2. We're all familiar with Part 1. That has now become ISO 17799, which is the Code of Practice for Information Security Management. That is actually very tightly linked with Part 2, which is under consideration for adoption as an international standard, and we'll probably get there within the next probably 3, 4, 5 years, I would guess. And what Part 2 does is it defines what are called information security management systems. And you might as well just replace the word systems with programs. In a nutshell, it covers all of the items that I listed on the previous slide, as well as some additional ones as well. And really, provides the framework for building up the information security program, running it, and making sure that it stays alive and maintained well. And then finally, I'll close with some predictions. Based on the laws and regulations that we've looked at, I think that it's safe to say that if there are future legislative actions, they will probably conform to the type of model that we've seen developed here. They'll have the management component, they'll increasingly have the management component, and they will increasingly define the types of tactical control measures that need to be put in place by every organization. That model will probably continue to be followed if there's more legislation. I also think that data privacy will continue to be one of the primary drivers of information security law and regulation, just as it was with GOBA and HIPAA. However, I also think that more systems-driven types of laws and regulations will also be part of the future. Think back to the national strategy, where they're talking about issues not just of, for example, confidentiality with data privacy, but availability issues. If a significant portion of the internet, I think the majority of the internet, is owned privately, is in private hands, if the availability of the internet is compromised or jeopardized by the behavior of those private sector entities, then there may be some regulation that dictates more, that targets them directly and says, look, do this, because unless we have a healthy internet, everybody's going to suffer. So a more systems-driven approach may be something that we'll see in the future. I also think if you look at, Putnam was a Republican. I don't think that he went through the trouble to draft that legislation just because he had nothing better to do with his time. I think he was probably serious about it. But on the other hand, the Bush administration's approach is very much one of self-regulation, at least if you look at the national strategy. It's interesting to observe that one of the persons primarily responsible for putting that document together, Richard Clark, who used to be the head of cybersecurity, the cybersecurity czar for the Bush administration, previous administration, who is now on the outs with the Bush administration, is essentially opposing a lot of the stuff that he helped come up with. And so, it's my suspicion that essentially, he was kind of under the gun, he had to play nice, but now he's recanting a lot of the stuff that he said in the national strategy. So, with that in mind, I think it's safe to say that if the Bush administration continues in power through November, and I don't want to get into political debate here at all, but I think it's safe to say that if Bush is reelected, these types of laws and regulations will probably occur later rather than sooner. And if a more Democrat administration comes in, Kerry, for example, then they will probably occur sooner rather than later. But that's just my own observation. At this point, I want to thank everybody here. You've really been a great audience. It's been a privilege speaking to you. It's really nice to be able to speak to a group of my peers, and I'm very proud to be able to do it, and you guys are all great. So thank you very much, and if there is any time, I would be happy to entertain any questions that you have. I'll also be at the reception tonight, so we can talk there. And if you have any other questions, you can always send an email to me, and I'll get back to you for sure. So does anybody have any questions?
3 minutes for questions.
What's that? 3 minutes. 3 minutes for questions. Sir. Mm-hmm. That's a good observation. Anybody else?
I have a question for you.
Yeah, shoot.
Surveying guards can be affected by the executives possibly going to prison. What's considered an executive? What does that exactly mean?
Well, there's... There are certain officers, including the chief executive officer and then the chief financial officer or somebody within the organization that holds the same functional role, that are required to sign off on management's assessment. So if they sign off on it and it's the third-party auditor comes in and says this is bullshit, then because of that signature, because of that certification, that's the reason why they can go to jail.
So when I hear a chief security officer say I could go to jail, I'm not exactly
I don't think that chief security officers are required to sign the document, not as far as I'm aware. Yeah. Yeah. Yep.